Welcome to Other Plans on KDNK, Louis. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I just want to go back to the beginning a bit and get an understanding about where you are now and how you got there. So it's my understanding that your parents met in a Unitarian church. Do you know how they got into Unitarianism or anything about their first encounter?
My understanding is that, and unfortunately, you know, there's always that laundry list of things that you wish you could go back and ask your, you know, your relatives, you know, to get clarification on. But I'm pretty sure that they both came from Unitarian families.
Do you know anything or have any clue about how they met?
Yeah, they were both members of the Unitarian youth group. As a Unitarian young adults, maybe even young adult singles group through their church, which was called All Souls Unitarian Church in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Is there an early memory of your life growing up that you'd like to share as we start off?
I have a fairly robust memory, so I have a lot of those, so I have to kind of cherry pick through. But, you know, I think probably one of my most kind of relevant memories from back in those days, I used to hang around in my dad's organ repair shop. My dad repaired electronic organs and actually pipe organs as well. So I used to, you know, hang around at his repair shop a lot. He actually got me into, he taught me how to use a soldering iron and how to, he had me basically doing piecework at a pretty young age, you know, probably 8 or 9 years old. I was preparing organ parts, you know, kind of one of the early ones.
Now that you mentioned the organ repair shop, did you spend much time in other churches because of that business?
Yeah. So I used to go, on Saturdays, I would go to work with my dad. We always got to go out for fast food. That was one of my big motivators. That was kind of a novelty back in those days. And, but anyway, we would pretty much spend the day going from one church to another. And, because his answering machine would fill up with phone calls from the churches in Denver on Friday night saying, you know, such and such note is out or such and such not working or the organ's completely dead or whatever. And so we would go around making sure that all of Denver's church organs were ready for Sunday worship, Sunday morning.
And your parents, they were both musical, and music has long been an important part of your life, as we all know, with your band, Louie and the Lizards. But what did your parents play?
So let's see. My mom was a first and foremost was a pianist and a piano teacher, and she actually started teaching me to play the piano when I was, I think, 6 years old. And she also, in high school and college, played the cello, and somewhere along the line, she learned how to play the guitar as well. And then she was also she played the recorder.
And what about your father?
So my father was primarily an organist. He started out playing the accordion when he was in grade school. And I've actually got this really awesome picture of him. He actually had a band in middle school. They were called the Rascals of Rhythm was the name of the band. And so anyway, he played the accordion back then, which is, you know, that's the same kind of keyboard as an organ. And then he learned to play the organ, and he also played the banjo a little bit.
So your mom taught you how to play the piano, but what instrument did you really connect with? What did you pick up that drove you to keep playing music?
Well, you know, I continued to play the piano all the way through, pretty much. But when I was in fourth grade, they have that that day in fourth grade where they take you to the auditorium and introduce you to all the instruments in the orchestra. And for some reason, I didn't even see it coming myself. I was very attracted to the trombone. And I came home at the end of the day that day and told my mom and said, I want to learn to play the trombone. I want to be in the band and play the trombone. And my mom was really surprised because that was the first she'd ever heard of it. So anyway, I started playing low brass instruments there in fourth grade. And I took to it pretty readily. I was, by the time I was in fifth grade, I was playing in the honor band and pretty much all the way through high school. Then at a certain point in the high school band, we had a real shortage of tuba players. I was the first chair trombone player out of, I think, five. And the band director made a summary announcement to the band, said, I'm looking for people who are interested in learning to play the tuba. And I came to him after band practice and I said, I'm interested in learning to play the tuba. And he said, no, not you. You're my first chair trombone player. I can't lose you. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I want to learn to play the tuba. I was very insistent about it. So I became a tuba player and actually took to that quite readily and ended up getting a scholarship to go to music school for my tuba playing. I wanted to be an orchestral tuba player when I got out of high school. That was plan A.
Like you said, you went to CSU on a music scholarship, and then at some point you decided that you wanted to go in a new direction in the middle of college and start cooking. How did that happen?
So the fairly early on, I had been working cooking jobs during summer break. And like right when I got out of high school, I immediately got a job cooking breakfast down at the Hot Springs pool and so on. About the middle of my sophomore year in college, I went out looking for a part-time job, and I landed a job working in a four-star, it was the classy, the swanky place in Fort Collins to go for dinner. And it was a four-star mobile travel guide rated restaurant, super fancy. Everything was like, a lot of stuff was cooked table side and, a lot of flambé and things like that. And I landed a job as what they call the pantry chef in that place. It kind of ties into an experience I had in middle school or early high school where I worked for a French chef that had a little cafe in Glenwood Springs. And so I'd already been kind of introduced to food as an art form at that point. And when I took this job at the Catacombs in Fort Collins, it really kind of dovetailed into that very nicely. So when I came back from college that year, I was very fired up about the food business and pretty quickly was working at the Ramada Inn and met a gal who was working as one of the dinner cooks there. I was still flipping eggs. I was breakfast cook. And I met this gal who was a dinner cook, and for multiple different reasons, because I was interested in her and I was interested in cooking dinner instead of breakfast, I asked to be moved to the dinner shift, and they did so, and one thing led to another. And by the end of the summer, my relationship with this gal had gotten to the point where I'd forgotten all about playing the tuba at that point. And I didn't go back to college. That cute little dinner cook ended up being she's my bride of 36 years now.
Do you remember, what can you tell us if you remember about your first encounter with her?
She worked the dinner shift and I worked the breakfast shift, and my lunch break was at 1:30. I'd get off at 2. So I got my lunch break at 1:30, and she would come in and be, get changing her clothes and putting her work shoes on and so on and so forth. And so it was just kind of casual conversation over, while I was eating my lunch or whatever. I don't really remember any of the content of that, but she was pretty cute and I was pretty interested.
And so just back to how you found yourself in the kitchen and thinking about food as an art, I'm just drawing an analogy between a group of people making music and a group of people making food, which you have done both. And it seems like to be good at either, there'd have to be some amount of personal expertise with some sort of shared vision, with someone leading the way. Is that how you find music and cooking as a chef?
Yeah, you know, I would say that the direction of my musical career as a rock and roll musician was more collaborative than my chefing. I was one of the real core attributes that I have that kind of drove my chefing was I have, it's not a photographic memory, but it's close. And there are not very many recipes that I got taught from the time I was, you know, an apprentice chef at La Rive Gauche at the age of 14 to the time when I got my first executive chef's job. There are not very many recipes that I forgot. So I had a pretty clear vision, and, you know, I guess kind of looking back, I was maybe a little bit domineering. You know, I was the alpha chef.
What would you say is your creative approach to food?
I had a number of really good teachers that taught me some real important basics. And so I have this really good basic grasp of the chemistry needed to make just about, I can definitely make anything look the way that I, you know, if I have a vision of how I want it to look. And then I've got a set of taste buds to help me make it taste the way that it's supposed to taste. And so I've spent a lot of time in my life doing what I call reverse engineering. You know, if I go out to eat at a restaurant and I like what I've had, one of the next things that's going to happen is I'm going to be experimenting in the kitchen, trying to, you know, come up with that from the back door side of it. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or not. You know, there is definitely a, you know, difference in my creative approach to the music and the cooking.
Did you grow up eating at home and or cooking for your family at all when you were younger?
You know, I didn't really cook very much, but I had my mom. I give my mom a lot of credit because she wasn't super adventurous with her cooking, but she came up with a really good rotation of, you know, 28 or 30 different things, recipes that were healthy and tasted good and looked good. And she, you know, kind of every now and then she'd stumble across a recipe or get a hankering to, you know, make something different. But she was just really good at focusing in on the things that work. And she stuck with it. And it's interesting because I'm just now actually kind of realizing, you know, that, you know, you kind of drew this out, this realization in me that that's really how I approached, you know, chefing. I found the things that work. And when I would build a menu or design a menu, I would usually start out with a collection of, you know, probably 40 or 50% of the things were, you know, those good staple items that I knew work and could be create or could be produced by a crew of not, you know, they're always skilled labor, but not super high skilled labor. You know, they were, so I had a really good foundation in my menu of, you know, those types of things, the things that were, you know, the kind of the old go-tos. So.
You were an apprentice at the age of 14, like you said, at a restaurant called La Rive Gauche in Glenwood. And before the interview, we talked about how the name comes from a part of Paris, which is known for being bohemian. So that's cool, but not chic. Does that describe the restaurant?
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah, the restaurant was definitely very bohemian, and it attracted a very bohemian crowd. You know, you would, you know, basically, you know, see Glenwood's artist community in there. You know, quite honestly, I'm willing to venture, it was literally the first place in Glenwood Springs you could get an espresso or a cappuccino. And he had a cappuccino machine. So, I mean, you could start it right off with high-powered caffeine right at the beginning.
Hmm. So. What was on the menu?
You know, it was really a who's who of classic French items. You know, I think one of the main, one of the big sellers on the breakfast menu was eggs Florentine. You know, there was always a big batch of hollandaise on the cook's line. Let's see, he used to do, I remember he taught me how to make, like we made a, one day made a noodle soup, and he taught me how to make noodles from scratch. And he did it with one of those big cone-shaped strainers and a wooden, it almost looked like a cut-off piece of a baseball bat that you would push the, you know, the dough through the holes in the strainer. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of work, you know. And, of course, I'm 14 years old. So I'm standing on a milk crate, you know, up in the cooking line and, you know, pushing this dough through the strainer.
Mm-hmm. So you worked there, and then at CSU in Fort Collins, you were also working at the well-known restaurant. But
yeah,
then,
it's called the Catacombs was the name of the place.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you met your wife, as you talked about, in the Ramada. At what age were you when you met your wife in the restaurant in the Ramada Inn?
Gosh, I had to be 20 at that point.
You eventually left for Lake Havasu, being in the restaurant and tourism industry here. That makes sense going there. And you worked there, but then you returned to Glenwood Springs to open up a restaurant named Avalon. Can you tell us more about your restaurant, Avalon?
Sure. So the Avalon Cafe, it was in the King Mall at 720 Grand in Glenwood. It was this really neat little, I think the space was originally a plant store, and it still had this beautiful fountain right in the middle of it. And like this whole little kind of like little flower box with a bunch of plants and stuff in it. A gal named Barb Haskey had turned it into, she was from New York City, and she wanted to create this kind of bohemian little cafe that was like something you would find like in the West Village in New York City. So she made this little, you know, built this little cafe there. And she wasn't really much of a restaurant person, and she kind of got burned out on it after a period of time. My sister-in-law knew about it. She knew Barb Haskey, and she informed us, actually, that we were going to be buying it. It was one of those family, she was giving us a leg up, basically. And so anyway, we went in there, and in about 20 days' time, from the time we closed on it to when we actually opened, we got it all spiffed up as well as we could. It was 38 seats. We later on went in, put in a cappuccino bar, and it had a little cooking station right out in the dining room. So I got to interact with my customers a lot. About 50% of the menu was vegetarian, and the whole menu was homemade. Everything was made from scratch in the place. And it was tremendously successful. But with only 38 seats, you can only do so much business, and people's lunch hours are only so long. So on a good day, we would turn the restaurant over twice. We'd do about, you know, around 80 lunches, I think, a day. Our all-time record was 165 on the Sunday of Mountain Fair in 1995, I think it was.
Did you have a favorite thing that you liked to cook for while you were at the cafe?
So let's see, at breakfast, I'm kind of notorious for my huevos rancheros, and most specifically when I was in high school, worked for a woman from New Mexico and learned how to make a really legitimate, pork green chili. And so that was one of the kind of the staple items on our menu. I always knew that if I was putting a huevos rancheros down in front of somebody, they were going to come away very impressed. At lunch, one of my cooks and I started doing this thing at the end of our shift where we would have a competition where we would take turns where the goal was make something out of all of the ingredients that are available on the cooking station. It was kind of a competition, so every day we would trade off. And one day she would make something, and the other day I would make something, and we kind of just go back and forth like that. And one day she made this dish with started with a pita bread, and then she put some hummus and some pesto and some sun-dried tomatoes and some feta cheese on it, and then she put that in the oven for a few minutes, and then she put some mixed greens with some balsamic vinaigrette and fresh tomatoes and some Parmesan cheese on top of it, and it was absolutely amazing. And we decided it was so good, we went, okay, this has to go on the menu. And we had to come up with a name for it. And I'm like, okay, it's a pita. And it's pretty much, it's a vegetarian thing, so it's all rabbit food. And I'm like, oh, we'll call it Pita Rabbit. That's how Pita Rabbit was born. And I still literally have people take me aside in the supermarket when I am out shopping and say, oh my God, when are you going to open another restaurant? I have to have another Pita Rabbit or another Huevos Rancheros. Anyway.
Well, do you have plans to open another restaurant in your lifetime? Is that on the
list? You know what? I do not. It's actually kind of funny you should ask me that, because I was talking to my son this morning, and my one fantasy about opening a restaurant, if I ever open another restaurant, I would do it in a place, in a situation where the menu has no prices on it. Because I heard of a restaurant like this out on East Colfax in Denver for a while, that basically the policy was leave what you think it was worth. And I've always wanted to do that. So I would have to kind of fold that humanistic element into it if I ever did it again.
And then back to your Huevos Rancheros, I just think when talking about eggs, there are so many different opinions on how to cook eggs and how to do them well, especially with scrambled eggs. I just wondered, when you're cooking omelets or scrambled eggs, do you use a fork or a whisk?
Probably a fork. And my main motivation is just because it's a lot easier to clean than a whisk.
That makes sense. Do you use milk or water?
I actually use neither.
Interesting.
I use just straight eggs.
I'm just thinking about your restaurant, Avalon. Do you remember what you had on the walls?
Absolutely. We had, when we first took the place over, there was some artwork by this amazing artist named, he was from the Basque country, named Gil Ladon. Guillermo Ladon was his name. And he had these large format, super colorful paintings up on the wall of, they were agricultural workers in the fields back in the Basque country. And I never forget, he got into financial bind and wanted to sell us one of them and made us, I think he wanted $400 for it. And I like literally kicked myself to this day for not going out and pawning something so I could buy it. But then a little bit later on, one of the other key elements of our restaurant was we had a couple of starving artists, a photographer and a painter. The painter is a very prominent Glenwood Springs figure named Gabe Liston. And Gabe Liston was our resident starving artist. He did a lot of our advertising work in exchange for food. And he also did a number of paintings that were that displayed and sold on the wall at the restaurant.
When you were in the kitchen, were you the type of person that was a shouter?
You know, no, I was actually regarded as like the nicest chef you ever worked with. At least that's what I called myself. But no, I was never that type of a chef. And the only time I would shout is when the orders were piling up in the window two or three deep and the food was getting cold, because one of the things that had been beaten into my consciousness at a young age as a budding chef was hot food hot, cold food cold. And when the hot food is not staying hot, I get very antsy. That's about the only time you'll hear me raise my voice.
That's interesting. Just because some chefs have a reputation for being, there's a certain vibe of chefs, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, they sure do. They sure do. And I worked for plenty of them, and I actually walked off the job from several of them.
And somehow, while in the restaurant business, you learned about computers and technology, and that became part of what you do now, today. And can you talk about this transition?
Sure. My last job working for somebody else in the food business, prior to the Avalon, right before the Avalon, I was working at this big resort down in Lake Havasu, Arizona. And I had always wanted to be an executive chef. I always wanted that title. And I got there and found out very quickly that executive chefs don't actually cook. Not a true executive chef. You're a number cruncher. You're an administrative taskmaster. And it very quickly became apparent to me that that was not going to work for me. And so I went to one of my managers and I said, you know, I see that you guys have me crunching numbers for 6 hours a day, doing basic math, doing these silly little reports that you have me do. Don't they make computers that can do this? And she said, yeah, as a matter of fact, they do. Would you like me to teach you? And I said, sure. And so she got me set up with one of the computers in the administrative suite that I could use and off hours. She taught me how to create spreadsheets, and I took to it very readily. And I continued playing with computers. And when my wife and I opened the Avalon, I pretty quickly got a computer to manage all the bookwork for that. And then when the Avalon closed, I had done enough with computers that I pretty quickly I printed up business cards and said, I'm going to be a computer guy now.
Do you want to talk about what you have going on now?
Yeah. So, my business, shortly after the Avalon closed, I got into a partnership with my father, and we kind of had a combination electronics repair and computer repair business. It was called Mountain Keyboard and Computer Service, and I hung on to that name for a number of years, and it's basically a computer consulting business. I work on Macs and PCs. I help people learn how to get their computers to do what they want them to do. I work on computer hardware, do networking, all kinds of stuff. Done a lot of really crazy, arcane computer jobs, and worked for a lot of different kinds of businesses, and that's one of the things that I really like about it. But at a certain point, I decided that name was a little bit too long and esoteric, and I was scrambling for a new name for my business, and I just thought to myself one day, I'm like, you know, everybody in the Valley goes, you know, Louie the computer guy, and I'm like, there it is, there's my new business name, and so I adopted that name, Louie the computer guy, and got a new set of business cards, and registered the name, and so that's who I am now.
And you also have a radio show on KDNK called Geek Speak. And And when is that?
That is first and third Mondays of the month at 4:30. And we try to keep it light, but people can call in if their printer's not working, or, you know, if they have a question or they're getting ready to buy a particular gadget and they want our opinion about it. We're there to do that. We spend a lot of time trying to educate our listenership because there's an awful lot of hijinks going on with criminals using cyber technology to take people's money. And we try to keep it light. We try to joke around a little bit. I originally kind of formulated it and tried to make it as similar to Car Guys as I could. We're talking about computers instead of cars.
How do you feel, because music is such a part of your life still, how do you feel the internet has affected the music business?
Let's put it this way. I'd say that two-thirds of what I listen to right now, were it not for, I was using Pandora right when it first came out. Not that it's my preferred method of getting music anymore, but Pandora does this thing called genetic typing of music. And so if you put in, you know, the name of your favorite band, it'll play a couple songs by that band, but then it'll start introducing music that has similar, what they call genetic characteristics. And I would say that about two-thirds of what I listen to at this point in time is music that I would have probably never stumbled upon, you know, living here in the Roaring Fork Valley. And so I like that part of it. I like it as a musician because I feel like, likewise, it's a two-way street. Other people have been exposed to my music that would have never heard it before. I've actually had phone calls, and I've actually done interviews and done little mini shows on radio stations. One of them was in Hawaii. The other one is out in Delaware. So, you know, it's like, and I just can't see those without the internet and the awareness or accessibility to my band and our music. I don't think I would have gotten to do any of that.
The listeners here certainly know you, and they know about, most of them know about Louie and the Lizards. So, of course, I want to talk about that. And you started this band in the 90s, right?
Yep. Yeah, it was 1998, I think, was our first gig was at the Black Nugget, New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1997.
I read an article that referenced that your band was going to break up, but you're still playing to this day, right?
Yeah, we've had some ups and some downs. Part of it had to do with my brother has been the other, like, real pillar of the, you know, of the whole thing, and he's the guitarist. And at a certain point, he met the girl of his dreams on eHarmony.com and decided he was going to move to Utah to be with her. And so I couldn't really see a future for the band without him after that point. And so that was our, we had a final, it was a New Year's Eve gig at a place out called the Brickyard in Rifle. And that's probably the article you came across. And I took a little bit of a break and I started interviewing or auditioning other players and kind of put something together and did a few things, fits and starts for a couple of years, but it just never really came together. Probably 5 or 6 years ago, my parents were in failing health and my brother decided to move back to the area to spend as much time with them as he could. And pardon the cliche, but we got the band back together.
Do you have any superstitions as a band or yourself before you go to perform?
You know, one of the only superstitions that I've kind of given into honoring is there's a superstition about rehearsing the night before a performance that I've always honored. And I think part of that's just kind of making sure you don't tire yourself out type of thing. Another superstition, I don't know if it's a superstition, but a lesson that I've learned is never take a new piece of equipment and use it for the first time in a performance. That's a recipe for disaster.
And what is a favorite song that you have that you perform?
Probably one, my favorite tune that we do is this song called Funky Cowboy. And the song, It was done by a really obscure, what they call a psychobilly group. There was a rockabilly kind of fell into the hands of a bunch of young, you know, psychedelic musicians. So this song, Funky Cowboys, like, it's the song that we generally open with. And we perform it, in my opinion, really well. And it just kind of lays down the law. It's like, okay, this is what we're all about, you know. That's my fave.
When's your next show coming up?
Our next show is, we are playing, we're actually, our long-time beloved bass player, Tom Mercer, just moved out of town probably this morning. And so I'm breaking in a new bass player. I'm taking a little bit of a break, but we are going to be playing Oktoberfest up in Craig, Colorado, on the 24th of September.
You had told me that you are 19 years sober, and I just want to talk a little bit about that. Do you think that you started these habits when you were working in restaurants? Because when you think about restaurants and the restaurant industry, I've been in the restaurant industry too, and drugs and alcohol are associated with that industry. Do you think that led to your addiction?
You know, I would say that certain ideologies or philosophies that I adopted from, you know, what we call my family of origin, contributed more to me actually becoming an addict. But the restaurant business provided me with a really good, we'll just call it pardon the pun. It was kind of like a food court of like experiencing all kinds of different drugs. So it made a number of different things accessible to me, and I was able to, you know, figure out what I liked the best and what was going to get me into trouble the best.
You mentioned to me that you came upon a book. You're into thrifting with your wife, or you were. And at one point you were in a thrift store and you came across a book titled Suffering is Optional, I believe.
Yep.
I wondered if you wanted to tell how that caught your attention.
Yeah. So that was at a period of time at a certain point in my addiction, I was abusing prescription drugs, and my doctor kind of got wise to me, and he stopped giving me the medication that I was addicted to. In the throes of withdrawal and some really bad decision-making, I decided that I could just start writing my own prescriptions. So I did that, and I got away with it for a while, but every criminal gets caught eventually, and I got caught. I got put into this, what they call a diversion program, the drug court program in the Ninth Judicial District, and which is an alternative to going away to prison for people that have committed felony crimes. And about halfway through that, it's a hard program. I mean, if you go in and you really put your all into it, it's a hard program. And I got to the point where I was suffering pretty severely when I came across, because I mean, these guys, they show up and do home visits, and you know, go in and do drug testing anywhere between 3 and 5 times a week, and you go to court every 2 weeks, and you go to therapy twice a week, and it's a load, it's a heavy lift. So I was really suffering, and I really wanted to be anywhere in the world but where I was doing what I was doing. So I came across that book, and I was like, wow, suffering is optional. That's an idea I can really get behind. And I took it home and I started reading it. And it turned out it was a guide to an introduction to meditation. About halfway through the book, the lady says, oh, by the way, this is Buddhist stuff. I had been coming from my Unitarian background that I came from. I was having a really difficult time connecting with a higher power, which is a really important part of a recovery program, at least one of the ones that I was doing at that time. So I was like, whoa, maybe this works. Maybe the Buddha is gonna, maybe Buddhism, that's gonna be my higher power. So I started digging a little bit deeper after I finished that book. The book was very helpful for me, and I started doing a little bit deeper digging, and ended up being it's kind of what I identify as, these days.
Congratulations on being 19 years sober.
Thank you.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I wondered if you think that there are some parallels between Unitarianism and Buddhism.
I, at least far as my understanding of Unitarianism, because it was one of those things where the more your parents want you to do something, the less likely you are to do it, I think. And my poor parents, they wanted me to like go and become part of the Unitarian, because my parents actually started the Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist congregation here in the Valley. And they wanted me to be part of that force more than anything in the world. As busy as my life was, especially when I was in the restaurant business, on Sunday mornings, I'm getting up, getting ready to feed a couple hundred people breakfast, So, and then even after the restaurant closed, I still, I got up on Sunday morning. It's like, okay, I can either take a shower and put on some really nice clothes and go to church, or I can make some pancakes. and so I never really did it. But my understanding of Unitarianism, the whole Unitarian concept, is that it's a place where people who feel like misfits and outcasts and rejects from all other organized religions can go and be accepted and appreciated. And so it's not unusual that you'll be sitting, because I've done a fair amount of time in Unitarian, I would go on holidays and such. And it's not unusual to find yourself sitting next to some people that are Judaism, or Jewish people on your left, and somebody who's into Islam on sitting to your right. And so it really is. And, of course, there's a whole community of people that are estranged from the Catholic Church for all different kinds of reasons. And so anyway, yeah, it's I don't see a lot of parallel with Buddhism, but there are Buddhists there as well. It's a great place for refuge for people that want the community of a church, but
don't want to be told exactly what to believe.
Do you practice Buddhism now on a regular basis?
You know, I do, but I have a very... My original teachers taught me that Buddhism is, and it's Zen Buddhism, is this, you know, there are specific sects or, you know, subgroups of Buddhism. Zen Buddhism basically tells me that as soon as I become attached to the idea that I have to sit on a particular type of cushion or burn a particular type of incense or whatever, then I've pretty much just gone backwards, the attachment of a bunch of rigid ideas about how I have to practice. And so, I mean, I've been known to do what I call driving meditation, where if I'm, you know, got something that's really disturbing me and I'm having a really difficult time staying out of the future or the past, I'll just pick a rock on the pavement. I'll watch it go underneath my car, and then I'll pick another rock and I'll watch it go underneath my car. And before you know it, I'm in Carbondale. I haven't suffered in the meantime. I believe that if you can really get to a place of mindfulness, and I actually have a kind of contentious relationship with the word mindfulness because I feel like it's been kind of abused these days. You know, if I can be completely in the moment sitting here having this conversation with you, or, you know, even when I'm removing a virus from a customer's computer, or playing a song or whatever, or cooking tandoori chicken fettuccine, if I can be completely present for that, then I'm a winner, you know. Mm-hmm. I achieved everything that I want out of Buddhism.
And yeah. What's next for you, Louis? Is there anything major coming up in your life?
Well, let's see. So my wife and I were able to buy a house for the first time at the age of, I think we were 57 when we bought it. We bought it right before COVID hit. So we are having an absolute blast fixing up our house.
Great.
And so for the immediate future, there's going to be a lot of that, you know. And this summer has been dedicated to putting in a really nice kind of bohemian garden in front of our house. So I'm just going to kind of take it one day at a time. I think we're going to rent a Sprinter and go up to Wyoming in early October and do hot springs and stuff. And, you know, that's about as far out as my plans go at this point.
Well, so, that's great. Yeah. Well, Louis, yeah. It's been really fun getting to know you and talking with you and being able to share this with the Katie and Kay listeners and those that already know you. So thanks.
Well, I feel very honored that you asked me to do it. Thank you.